Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Begging the state to give you something is based, after all, on the notion that the state is your friend. And for much of the world, the state is not really their good friend, because the state is actually the friend of their exploiters, whether it's capitalists or big landowners or whatever. That the state is not the friend of the oppressed, or they wouldn't be oppressed. So to ask that power to remedy the situation seems to me politically incredibly naive, when in fact, and it's interesting now, particularly in among Indigenous people in Canada, particularly around the pipelines, which are obviously a major issue in the West, of Indigenous people saying, we're telling you that you are not going to build that pipeline. Not that we have a right to this, that, or the other thing, but no, you're simply not going to do that. We are not going to permit it. We are responsible for caring for the land. The state has been totally negligent in fulfilling its responsibility, so we simply have to take it upon ourselves to protect the land. And that's certainly a major shift in power and thinking about power.
That's the voice of Dr. Bruce DeKing, author of Tyranny of Rights. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Keane about the individualistic Western notion of rights and how we need to move to more of an Indigenous model and stop pleading to the state for rights. So stay tuned.
Our next guest, Dr. Bruce Tertnin, who joins us from Ontario, his book, The Tyranny of Rights. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes.
I was completely captivated by the reading of your book, The Tyranny of Rights, which I guess, you know, for people growing in Canadian context with the illusion that we are somehow devoid of any colonization history, as was proposed by one of our government officials only a few years back, this book may be a bit provocative and shocking, but I think that the majority of the world would agree with you that under the banner of rights, many injustices are committed today. How does this concept of right come into our consciousness? How does it become this overarching power over us that somehow we just, you know, become subservient to it?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we need to recognize is that the culture which has given rise to the language of rights is a highly individualistic culture. And rights, if one really stops to think about it, is always expresses an individual interest, and you can trace it back to certain figures in Western so-called civilization where property rights are the foundation of in a sense of the function of the state, but those are essentially individual. And even where people talk about collective rights, I seriously question that as a concept. So it's individualism. But I also think that there's another dimension which needs a lot of examination, and that is the notion of somehow, as human beings, rights, our rights, come first, not our responsibilities. And when I was doing the book, I started looking at languages and cultures, and I discovered that, to all intents and purposes, as far as I could figure out, the word rights is strictly found in the European cultures. In any indigenous language, there is no word for rights, or in languages like Turkish or Japanese or Bangladeshi or the word rights doesn't appear. The concept is always responsibility. And I think that is so so fundamental.
I'm so glad that you point out the difference between rights as something that I'm entitled to and responsibility. To me, that's the ability to respond as well. Could you talk a little bit about the significance then that this has in how we become oblivious or at times complicit to the relationships of power that organize our economic, our relationships with nature, our relationships with in regards to what cultures are valorized, you know, the way that we see each other effectively. How does this distance between, you know, not recognizing that we are our ability to respond rather than, you know, what I think belongs to me affects how we see each other?
Well, what struck me in thinking about the use of rights when it began getting me, people talking about, for example, the right to food, and asking this is basically saying we have a right to food, and say, fine, how is that to be granted? How is that fulfilled? And the expectation, and I think in all rights discussion, is that the state or some form of the state is the power that is looked to grant the rights, but it doesn't say anything about actually fulfilling the right. So it's a hollow concept. But even behind that, simply asking or begging the state to give you something is based, after all, on the notion that the state is your friend. And for much of the world, the state is not really their good friend, because the state is actually the friend of their exploiters, whether it's capitalists or big landowners or whatever. That the state is not the friend of the oppressed, or they wouldn't be oppressed. So to ask that power to remedy the situation seems to me politically incredibly naive, when in fact, and it's interesting now, particularly in among Indigenous people in Canada, particularly around the pipelines, which are obviously a major issue in the West, of Indigenous people saying, we're telling you that you are not going to build that pipeline. Not that we have a right to this, that, or the other thing, but no, you're simply not going to do that. We are not going to permit it. We are responsible for caring for the land. The state has been totally negligent in fulfilling its responsibility, so we simply have to take it upon ourselves to protect the land. And that's certainly a major shift in power, in thinking about power.
The other part that I always think when considering this discourse of rights, it's presented as if it was a universal concept that everybody acknowledges, and that everybody's equal and able to participate in the same way. Can you speak to this?
Yeah. Well, as I was saying about language, and that's when you start looking and say, wait a minute, if there is no word for rights in virtually any non-European language, what does it mean to say it's universal? This is nonsense. So you start there, but then I think in terms of the kind of culture, and I mentioned this in terms of individualism, it's a very Western notion, and not one that, again, is shared. And when I was in writing the book, I got to looking at, well, okay, where did rights formally enter the language? And there's some interesting work been done. Unfortunately, there was a couple of books that came out after mine, and I couldn't use them, describing the rise of rights basically as a post-World War II phenomena that had a very particular context, and it was in the United Nations, at a time when the United Nations, it might have been the United Nations, but there was nothing universal about it. It was the Western victors of World War II, and not most of the world's population that was represented. And the veto power stayed in the hands of the same people that have got it now, i.e. the United States, France, England, and a couple of others. And this is, again, it's not universal. It's a very particular culture.
I was thinking about how rights not only define how we see each other, but what we allow to do or to be done in our name to other people. And particularly the right to intervene seems to be very high in the psyche of the current government. And that, you know, a coup happened in Paraguay last month, and immediately our government was first to recognize the new president as, you know, legitimate. Meanwhile, the entire hemisphere, the entire Latin American continent, has rejected the coup that took place. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about rights, we dismiss an entire other alternative, and that is justice, right? And I think justice can also be equally controversial, because it's again a word that when you name something, you limit so much other possibilities. But speaking specifically about the way in which governments use their power, the legislative power, you know, in terms of laws that supposedly mm-hmm. grant rights and limit the rights of other, how else can we imagine our society? Is there an alternative to this tyrannical way of organizing and becoming subservient to?
It's quite true. And I think that's very interesting in the movements that have over the past, basically the last year, for example, in the Occupy movement, of self-organizing, of saying we have to find a much better way of organizing our lives than this oppositional, antagonistic, competitive culture that is going to destroy the world if it carries on. And I think I find, you know, for example, the prime minister were talking about being an economist and mouthing the line about how we have to be competitive. I think that feeds right into the rights, supports the rights arguments about individualism and my rights come first, instead of thinking about my responsibilities and the question of, which is really the question that needs to be faced in terms of governance and the state, is how are we going to learn to live together? Because if you put the question that way, then it isn't just a question, it's a question of social organization, but also how do we treat the world about us? How do we treat Pachamama? How do we treat Mother Nature, or whatever term you want to use, in our relationships to the environment? That's got to be part of it. And I think, you know, more fundamentally, or not maybe more fundamentally, but in a different expression, that one of the problems of the rights language is that, whether we intend it or not, it translates moral issues into legal issues. This is very convenient in terms of relieving us of personal responsibility and saying, oh, we have to go to the courts. And then we find that indeed now, in what is supposed to be a democratic society, most of the important social issues are ending up going to the courts, because that's where we've defined justice. But we don't have any notion of carrying it out prior to our translation into legal issues.
I was thinking about reading your book, because you talk about, you know, all the different kinds of rights and the different kinds of ways in which it divides us from nature, it divides us from each other, it divides us from our responsibility to keep our instruments of governance accountable, right? Whether yeah. it's government, whether it's economic, whatever. But I was thinking about, you know, this very anthropocentric view of the world, you know, where humans are on top, nature is below, and even within that hierarchy there are differences, right? Not all humans are equal. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this, because in Canada we live in a country that supposedly have two nations coexisting side by side. The treaties of 1760 declare indigenous people their sovereign nation. They're independent. They're not ruled by the crown. They're not, you know, subjects of the state. And yet, when we look at the kinds of expansions of mining extraction that are taking place, these are predominantly taking place in indigenous land, in First Nations people's land, and these are, you know, almost invisible to the majority of the population under this discourse of rights, because suddenly the newspaper says, well, there's only, you know, 1,500 people living in this reservation. Why should they block this mining company that's going to bring 300 jobs or whatever it is, the number that they propose? So can you talk about the way the legal system has in many ways prevented the possibility for a just system that acknowledges the damage of colonization and the damage of genocide that has taken place in this land?
One of the things I've noticed, I have had asked a variety, several lawyers that I knew personally, and regardless as having integrity, to read the Tyranny of Rights and comment. And curiously, I have, that's the last I've ever heard from any of them. Having said, oh yes, I promise I'll do this, and so on, by such and such a date, they don't. And I think the reason is quite simple. The questioning rights is questioning the basis of law in as we understand it. And the legal profession doesn't, as somebody said, well, you're questioning their theology, the whole basis of law. And if law is about property rights and protection, then that's getting right to the heart of the injustice of our society. So it's a curious thing, to my mind, that you can't really discuss this issue. But I think the other aspect of that is that we don't bring into and must, and you're mentioning mining companies and so on, is the notion of the corporation as a person, that a corporation has rights. And this is, if one simply cleanses one mind of a whole lot of propaganda and say, wait a minute, why does a corporation, which is designed to protect individuals from responsibility, then have no responsibility itself either? But it has lots of rights. It can make claims as if it were a person, but without the responsibility. And hey, wait, this is a very weird situation we've created, where we give rights to a corporation that we don't recognize even in persons. This is where the whole legal system has to be questioned, and where we think power resides in the society.
When I think about authors that have written on this issue, Arundhati Roy is a poet, and she writes that, you know, we used to talk about justice, but now, she says, we talk about rights, and of those, only a few will do. But it, you know, she's kind of writing tongue-in-cheek and a bit you know, sardonically about it. However, it is what shapes our waves of seeing the world today. So it comes right down to the question you just raised, you know, private property. How does the notion of private property play a role into this dominant discourse of rights? And can we undo that system? And what would that be like?
We give priority to property over people. I mean, in our strange political economy, which we don't call, it was interesting that I was studied economics in the days when it was political economy, and that's a very different field than what economics has come to be, which is an abstraction that isn't about how people organize their lives together, but how people accumulate capital. And that means via property. I mean, it's just, you can't separate those two. And you've got, landowners' rights and rights to this, rights to that. In most cases, it comes down one way or another to the rights of property. And I mean, the disputes over intellectual property, which is such a weird, weird notion, that ideas can be owned and that seeds can be owned. And you can have rights to seeds belonging to a corporation when seeds are the basis of life. You say something has gone radically wrong in our thinking. And that's why I think we need to go and make some radical alterations, and not just reforming our political system, but actually working to build a system of governance that is about how we live together, not how we exploit each other.
You know, what I think also is that we have been almost captivated by monoculture, and in many ways that monoculture has expanded to our intellectual monoculture. You know, it's like one size fits all, right?
And
so the notions of indigenous people have been ignored and at times co-opted and appropriated and then, you know, readjusted to fit the needs of, you know, corporate or private property, or as you point out, you know, this corporation rights. A corporation is immortal, it's forever. No human being is immortal. So how can they possibly have the same rights? How could they possibly, you know, be excused from their responsibility but be able to enjoy all our rights? In writing this book, how do you see us moving forward? Well, where will this end? Where will this discourse of rights take us?
As I said earlier, I think one of the interesting, most hopeful signs, and it cropping up here and there, but certainly among indigenous people, and I think I might go out on a limb and say that I think perhaps civilization, as we have referred to it, needs to give way to traditional knowledge and ancient cultures of the indigenous peoples, who never, they've been roped into and beguiled into joining the dominant Western civilization. But when you look at the outcome of that, that's not a very, does not offer a very attractive future at this point. So I think when people say, okay, we're not going to go to court to defend our right to live the way we are, we are going to do so. We're going to work on the reconstruction of our foodways, our language, our culture, and we're going to protect the land. And if it means stopping your destruction of the world we live in, you're going to have to roll over us with your bulldozers and not just the trees and everything else. And I think there's a similar sensibility in the Occupy movement that says, we're not going to protest on Parliament Hill anymore. That's useless. That's the problem. The whole notion that we have a democratic government and that that's where your rights reside and are protected is clearly nonsense now, given the Harper regime and its dictatorial powers. So I think that's where we have to change our way of thinking, and that's a major, major undertaking. But I take heart with the people much younger than I am who say, well, we're starting now. We're going to figure out how we can work together across these lines and how to listen to the indigenous peoples and be part of it. And that's true globally, I think. So it isn't any great formula or looking to the state or once we are in power and so on, but no, we have to start now. Restructuring our relationships and our priorities, and that's our only choice.
I think you're right. You know, when I look at Latin America, I think that if we've learned anything from our sad history of genocide and colonization, is that we as a people have been resilient. We've seen worse times and we will see better times because it is people ultimately that change the world. Nothing else. You know what I mean? It is us working together, thinking in different ways, communicating in ways that are not individualistic and sharing that makes us survive, that makes us thrive, that makes us do better things. So I am like you. I think that, you know, we are in a transitional phase at this point, and I do see a world transform and you know, and different than what we've lived for this.
Let me give you one little anecdote. There was a demonstration, a manifestation, I think is a better term, organized in solidarity with the Quebec students a little while ago, a few weeks ago here. It started in Confederation Square, and there was a few short speeches and a fair bit of noise, and then we started off on a walk. But it wasn't a walk to Parliament Hill. It was a walk in the opposite direction. And I thought, oh, hooray, hooray. We walked instead of the Parliament Hill, went the other way, walked through the condominium and apartment area with pots and pans banging and people throwing open their windows and leaning out the windows with their pots and pans and people on balconies and people on the street corner. And in solidarity and an expression of, hey, this is fun. And we're not, in a sense, there was no message except to say, we're here and we're going to stay. No, we're not looking to Parliament. We're fed up with that. So let's go. What are we going to do? It was exhilarating.
Exactly. And that's what it takes. I think it takes celebrating who we are, celebrating that we're more than what we're told, you know, by silly laws. And that, you know, that the possibilities are endless when we work together. We know what the problem is. Now let's use our creativity to solve it.
But to talk about overthrowing capitalism, that's a big challenge.
And one that we can do. So thank you so much for your beautiful book, The Tyranny of Rights. For people who would like to access your book, how can they access your book?
The simplest way to get my book at this point is to go to our website, which is simply ramshorn.ca, ramshorn.ca. And there you will find our newsletter, including an article on Paraguay, a very good one, and our newsletter and books and everything.
Thank you again for being with us.
You're welcome.
Take care.
It's a pleasure.
My guest is Brewster Neen. He is the author of The Tyranny of Rights.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.